Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Here's our first article, and no surprise at all, this involves a recent trade deal made between the United States and the European Union. The article is by Jason Ma. It's from Fortune magazine, and it's dated July 28th. The U.S. and the EU reach a trade deal that sets 15% tariff rate and pledges hundreds of billions in investments. The U.S. and European Union agreed on trade terms that include a 15% rate on most EU products, as well as hundreds of billions of dollars of investments in American industry. President Donald Trump and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen met in Scotland on Sunday to iron out the agreement. Trump said the EU will invest $600 billion in the United States and buy $750 billion of U.S. energy, with vast amounts of American weapons also in the mix. He also said the EU will be opening up their countries at zero tariff. Von der Leyen said the 15% rate was all-inclusive, but Trump said later that it didn't apply to pharmaceuticals and metals, though it does for autos. "I think that basically that concludes the deal," he told reporters. "It's the biggest of all the deals." Von der Leyen also said the agreement would rebalance trade between the two partners. The U.S. goods trade deficit with the 27-member EU was $235 billion in 2024, a 12.9% increase from 2023, according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representatives. She later confirmed that the $750 billion in U.S. energy purchases would come over the next 3 years, while adding that both sides will drop tariffs to zero on aircraft, plane parts, certain chemicals, and chip equipment, as well as some farm products, generic drugs, and raw materials. "No decision has been made on a rate for wine and spirits," she added. The Distilled Spirits Council of the United States hailed the agreement, though the U.S. and EU tariffs on spirits still must be negotiated. "We're optimistic that in the days ahead, this positive meeting and agreement will lead to a return to zero-to-zero tariffs for U.S. and EU spirits products, which will benefit not only our nation's distillers, but also the American workers and farmers who support them from grain to glass," CEO Chris Swanger said in a statement. But von der Leyen also introduced some uncertainty by saying the 15% rate does apply to pharmaceuticals, while also suggesting more details will come from the U.S. and that pharma overall is on a different sheet of paper. "A deal with America's biggest trading partner removes a key source of market uncertainty and the threat of a damaging trade war," Michael Brown, senior research strategist at Pepperstone, said in a note that European car market makers are among the big winners from the deal, as tariffs on autos will drop to 15% from the current 25%, securing a similar carve-out that Japan obtained last week. U.S. defense and energy stocks also stand to gain. Stocks hardly need much of an excuse to rally right now. "An agreement of the biggest ever deal," Trump's words, not mine, "not only removes a key left tail risk that the market had been concerned about, but also yet again reiterates that the direction of travel remains away from punchy rhetoric and towards trade deals done," he wrote. Heading into their meeting, Trump and von der Leyen said they saw a 50-50 chance of reaching a deal. Trump ruled out pharmaceuticals from any deal and said the tariff rate on the EU would not go below 15%. The EU already faces a 50% U.S. tariff on steel and aluminum. Without a deal by August 1st, the EU was set to get hit with a 30% reciprocal tariff, up from 10%. Last week, Trump reached a trade with Japan that set up a 15% rate and included a pledge for Tokyo to invest $550 billion in key U.S. industrial sectors, with Trump able to direct the funds. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Japan's investment offer was key to clinching a trade deal and suggested it could help other countries get a comparable rate, though Wall Street analysts have expressed skepticism that the money will fully materialize. In fact, Trump has hinted that the EU would have to buy down the threatened tariff rate of 30% and pointed to the Japan deal. In case no deal with the U.S. was made, the EU had already pre-planned retaliatory tariffs of up to 30% on more than $100 billion of goods in American exports, such as aircraft, cars, and bourbon whiskey. Meanwhile, other U.S. trading partners are also staring down the August 1st deadline, and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said Sunday that no further extensions will be given. But the U.S. and China are reportedly extending their trade truce by 90 days, as talks between Bessent and Chinese Premier H. Lifeng, scheduled to start on Monday in Stockholm. Without an extension, their tariff pause was scheduled to end on August 12th. When Japan broke down and made a deal, the EU had little choice. The biggest piece in the trade deal puzzle still remains, and the Chinese are unlikely to be willing to fold, Jamie Cox, managing partner for Harris Financial Group, said in a note. The next big durable theme in markets is security, and the EU deal only accelerates it. Next is an article that deals with one of the major factors that the EU took into consideration before making the deal with the United States. Again, the article is by Jason Ma. It's from Fortune magazine, dated July 27th. Title of the article is, "Facing Russia's War on Ukraine, the EU couldn't risk fighting a trade war with the United States," analyst says. The trade deal President Donald Trump announced Sunday with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen didn't go over well in some parts of Europe. One French executive said Trump humiliated us, and French Prime Minister François Bayrou described the deal as submission. Economist Olivier Blanchard blasted it as completely unequal and a defeat for the EU. That's as the U.S. set a 15% tariff rate for most EU products, less than 30% Trump threatened, but more than the 10% Europe sought. The EU also pledged to invest $600 billion in the United States, to buy $750 billion of American energy products, and load up on a vast amount of U.S. weapons. But according to Robin Brooks, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, the deal isn't a defeat if you look at it from a different point of view. Instead, it's a recognition of economic and geopolitical realities, whereby the EU needs the U.S. more than the other way around, he wrote in a Substack post. At the end of the day, the EU needs U.S. weapons to keep Ukraine afloat into its struggle for survival against Russia. That just isn't a setting where you escalate a trade conflict. In fact, Trump has warmed up considerably toward the European view on Ukraine, which has been fighting off Russia's invasion for more than 3 years. After expressing deep skepticism on U.S. support for Kyiv, berating Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky at the White House, and temporarily cutting off military aid, Trump has helped reinforce Ukraine. Earlier this month, he vowed to send more Patriot missile defense systems to Ukraine and agreed to a plan where European nations buy American weapons, then transfer them to Ukraine. Trump has also indicated that he's fed up with Russian President Vladimir Putin's lack of progress in peace talks. And on Monday, Trump gave Moscow less than 2 weeks to reach a deal or else face steep sanctions. Meanwhile, analysts at McCary also noted that after markets previously saw the U.S. abandoning its global security obligations, the recent deals with the EU, UK, and Japan signal an effort to heal those relationships. In the background has been a renewed commitment to U.S. geopolitical engagement, a recommitment to Ukraine's security, taking out Iran's nuclear assets, etc., they said in a note. To be sure, Europe has also committed to rearming its own military forces and has pledged massive spending increases, including money for homegrown defense contractors. But that will take time, while NATO forces are already highly reliant on and integrated with American weapons systems. Despite recent transatlantic tensions, there is greater urgency in Europe to rearm, as the Russian threat looms over the entire continent, not just Ukraine. In February, the Danish Defense Intelligence Service assessed the risk from Russia once its Ukraine war stops or freezes in place. Russia could launch a local war against a bordering country within 6 months, a regional war in the Baltics within 2 years, and a large-scale attack on Europe within 5 years if the U.S. does not get involved, according to a translation of the report from Politico. Russia is likely to be more willing to use military force in a regional war against one or more European NATO countries if it perceives NATO as militarily weakened or politically divided, the report said. This is particularly true if Russia assesses that the U.S. cannot or will not support the European NATO countries in a war with Russia. Most of you have probably seen on the evening news articles and commentary on the Federal Reserve and its renovations and whether they are or are not over budget. This article, again, is by Jason Ma, dated July 26th from Fortune magazine. The title of the article is "Here's How the Federal Reserve Funds Itself, Including Renovations, Without Taxpayer Dollars." The White House's recent criticism of the Federal Reserve's headquarter renovation project has highlighted the central bank's sources of funding. Unlike federal departments that receive taxpayer dollars via appropriations from Congress, the Fed is self-funded, largely via interest income from government securities that it holds. The Federal Reserve's funding has come under scrutiny as the White House attacks the $2.5 billion headquarters renovation for cost overruns. The controversy was underscored on Thursday when President Donald Trump and Fed Chairman Jerome Powell disagreed over the cost during a visit to the central bank. Trump's allies have suggested the product could be grounds for ousting Powell, but the president has said he would not fire him, though Trump continues to demand lower rates. Unlike the Pentagon and a new weapons system that has blown through its budget, the Fed and its operations are funded differently. While the Defense Department and other executive branches receive money from Congress, the Fed is self-funded, largely via interest income from government securities that it holds. That means no taxpayer dollars have been appropriated for Fed operations, including building projects like the headquarters renovation. Most of the Fed's income comes from assets, such as treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities, that sit on the central bank's balance sheet and earn interest. That balance sheet exploded in size during the great financial crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic, as the Fed bought trillions of dollars of bonds to prop up the economy. Other sources of income include interest on foreign currency investments held by the Fed, fees for services like check clearing, funds transfers, and clearinghouse operations provided to depository institutions, and interest on loans to depository institutions. To be sure, the Fed's mission isn't to maximize its earnings from trading securities. Instead, it has a dual mandate of stable prices and maximum employment. Buying and selling assets is only a means for achieving those ends. Meanwhile, the Fed also has costs, including interest payments on reserve balances, interest payments on securities sold via repurchase agreements, and operational costs like payroll and its buildings. Costs go up when the Fed hikes interest rates like it did in 2022 and 2023 to tamp down inflation. When income exceeds those costs, the Fed hands over the surplus to the Treasury Department. In fact, in the decade before COVID, the Fed sent about $1 trillion to the Treasury. When the Fed costs exceed its income, the central bank creates an IOU, known as a deferred asset, to pay for operations. As interest rates rose, the Fed's deferred asset grew from $133 billion in 2023 to nearly $216 billion in 2024. As of Wednesday, it was $236.6 billion. Once rates come down further and income tops losses again, the Fed will pay back the deferred asset and then resume giving the Treasury any excess earnings. In conclusion, tighter monetary policy to rein in inflation has resulted in a reduction of net income for the Fed, the St. Louis Fed said in a 2023 explainer. This does not mean that the Treasury has to recapitalize the Fed, but rather that the Fed records a negative liability in the form of a deferred asset. This deferred asset accumulates until the Fed sees positive net income, which should happen once interest rates on the long-duration assets it owns start exceeding the interest paid on bank reserves and reverse repo facilities. We've done a number of articles on Boeing over the past few months, basically indicating the change in leadership and the status of business at Boeing. Although things are looking a little better, here's an article from John Hanna from Fortune magazine dated July 28th. The title of the article is, Boeing expects more than 3,200 fighter jet workers to strike after they reject contract offer, despite union leaders calling for a yes vote. Boeing company expects more than 3,200 union workers at three St. Louis area plants that produce U.S. fighter jets to strike after they rejected a proposed contract on Sunday that included a 20% wage increase over 4 years. The International Machinists and Aerospace Workers Union said the vote by District 837 members was overwhelmingly against the proposed contract. The existing contract was set to expire at 11:59 p.m. Central Time on Sunday, but the union said a cooling-off period would keep a strike from beginning for another week until August 4th. Union leaders had recommended approving the offer, calling it a landmark agreement when it was announced last week. Organizers said then that the offer would improve medical, pension, and overtime benefits in addition to pay. The vote came 2 days before Boeing planned to announce its second quarter earnings, after saying earlier this month that it had delivered 150 commercial airliners and 36 military aircraft and helicopters during the quarter, up from 130 and 26 during the first quarter. Its stock closed Friday at $233.06 a share, up $1.79. The union did not say specifically why members rejected the contract, only that it fell short of addressing the priorities and sacrifices of the union's workers. Last fall, Boeing offered a general wage increase of 38% over 4 years to end a 53-day strike by 33,000 aircraft workers producing passenger aircraft. Our members are standing together to demand a contract that respects their work and ensures a secure future, the union said in a statement. Dan Gillen, general manager and senior Boeing executive in St. Louis, said in a statement that the company is focused on preparing for a strike. He described the proposal as the richest contract offer ever presented to the St. Louis union. No talks are scheduled with the union, said Gillen, who was also vice president for Boeing Air Dominance, the division for the production of several military jets, including the U.S. Navy's Super Hornet, as well as the Air Force's Red Hawk training aircraft. Our next article is about AI and its effect on salaries and job layoffs. It's by Nino Paola and Nick Lichtenberg. It's from Fortune magazine, dated July 27th. AI is driving mass layoffs in tech, but it's boosting salaries by $18,000 a year everywhere else, study says. You've read about it all over, including the Fortune Intelligence. Maybe you or friends have been impacted. Artificial intelligence is already transforming work, not least hiring and firing. Nowhere is the impact more visible than in the labor market. The technology industry, the original epicenter of AI adoption, is now seeing many of its own workers displaced by the very innovations that they helped create. Employers racing to integrate AI into everything, from cloud infrastructure to customer support, are trimming human headcount in software engineering, IT support, and administrative functions. The rise of AI-powered automation is accelerating layoffs in the tech sector, with impacted employees as high as 80,000 in one count. Microsoft alone is trimming 15,000 jobs while committing $80 billion to new AI investments. But labor market intelligence firm Lightcast is offering a ray of hope going forward. Job postings for non-tech roles that require AI skills are soaring in value. Lightcast's new Beyond the Buzz report, based on analysis of over 1.3 billion job postings, shows that these postings offer 28% higher salaries, an average of nearly $18,000 more per year. The Lightcast research underscores the split in technology and non-tech hiring. Job postings for AI skills in tech roles remain robust, but the proportion of AI jobs within IT and computer science has fallen, dropping from 61% in 2019 to just 49% in 2024. This signals an ongoing contraction of traditional tech roles as AI claims an ever larger share of the work. Rather than stifling workforce prospects, Lightcast's research suggests that AI is dispersing opportunity across the broader economy. More than half of all jobs requesting AI skills in 2024 appeared outside the tech sector, a radical reversal from previous years, when AI was confined to Silicon Valley and computer science labs. Fields like marketing, HR, finance, education, manufacturing, and customer service are all rapidly integrating AI tools, from generative AI platforms that craft marketing content to predictive analytic engines that optimize supply chains and recruitment. In fact, job postings mentioning generative AI skills outside IT and computer science have surged an astonishing 800% since 2022, catalyzed by the proliferation of tools like ChatGPT, Microsoft Copilot, and DALL-E. Marketing, design, education, and HR are some of the fastest growers in AI adoption, each adapting to new toolkits, workflows, and ways of creating value. Cole Knapper, VP of Research, Innovation, and Talent Insights at Lightcast, told Fortune in an interview that he was struck by the lack of a discernible pattern for which industries were most affected by the explosion of AI skills present in job postings, noting that the arts come at the top of the list. For the workforce at large, AI proficiency is emerging as one of today's most lucrative skill investments. Possessing two or more AI skills sends paychecks even higher, with a 43% premium on advertised salaries. In 2024, more than 66,000 job postings specifically mentioned generative AI as a skill, a nearly fourfold increase from the prior year, according to Lightcast's 2025 Artificial Intelligence Index report. Large language modeling was the second most common AI skill, which showed up in 19,500 open job posts. Postings listed ChatGPT and prompt engineering as skills ranked third and fourth in frequency, respectively. Sectors such as customer client support, sales, and manufacturing reported the largest pay bumps for AI-skilled workers. As companies race to automate routine functions and leverage AI for competitive advantage, Christina Ng, founder of ThoughtLight, an AI marketing service, told Fortune in a message that AI isn't just automating busy work. It's becoming a tool AI-fluent workers can leverage to increase their own value to a company and to outperform their peers. Take, for example, someone in sales. Using AI to create more targeted conversations to close deals faster, Ng wrote. The same can be said for customer service workers. Customer service workers fluent in AI know how to interpret AI outputs, how to write clear prompts, and troubleshoot when things go off script, Ng said. That combination of human judgment and AI fluency is hard to find and well worth the extra pay. In fields like marketing and science, even single AI skills can yield large returns, while more technical positions gravitate to specialists with advanced machine learning or generative AI expertise. Crucially, the most valued AI-enabled roles demand more than just technical wizardry. Employers prize a hybrid skill set: communication, leadership, problem-solving, research, and customer service are among the 10 most requested skills in AI-focused postings, alongside technical foundations like machine learning and artificial intelligence. While generative AI excels at tasks like writing and coding, uniquely human abilities such as communication, management, innovation, and complex problem-solving are becoming even more valuable in the AI era, the study says. The emerging repercussions are striking. Tech workers whose roles are readily automated face rising displacement unless they can pivot quickly into emerging areas that meld business, technical, and people skills. Meanwhile, millions of workers outside of tech are poised to translate even basic AI literacy into new roles or wage gains. The competitive edge now lies with organizations and professionals agile enough to combine AI capabilities with human judgment, creativity, and business acumen. For companies, the risk is clear. Treating AI as an isolated technical specialty is now a liability. Winning firms are investing to embed AI fluency enterprise-wide, upskilling their marketing teams, HR departments, and finance analysts to build a future-ready workforce. AI may be the source of turmoil in Silicon Valley boardrooms, but its economic dividends are flowing rapidly to workers and companies in every corner of the economy. For those able to adapt, AI skills are not a harbinger of job loss, but a passport to higher salaries and new career possibilities. Still, the research doesn't indicate exactly where in the income levels the higher postings are coming. So Knapper says it's possible that we're seeing some compression, with higher paid tech jobs being phased out and lower paying positions being slightly better paid. Knapper said the trends of AI skills cropping up in job postings has exploded over the past few years, and he doesn't expect a slowdown anytime soon. Knapper said there's a cost to complacency, one that includes a significant salary cut. He added that the 28% premium, Lightcast plans to release follow-up research on what level of income ladder the trend is hitting the most. There have been many articles about battery EVs in all kinds of publications over the past 5 years. Here's an article from Fortune magazine by James Morris. Date of the article is July 28th, and it concerns hydrogen rather than an actual battery for operating a vehicle. Title of the article is BMW Backs Hydrogen for Transport with First Series Production Car in 2028. Is hydrogen the future after all? Hydrogen fuel cell cars, FCEVs, have been on the market for a similar duration to the current wave of battery EVs, BEVs, but they've sold a tiny fraction in comparison. In 2024, 12,866 hydrogen fuel cell cars were registered globally, versus 10.8 million battery electric vehicles. Still, some manufacturers have hopes that hydrogen has a role to play in transport. One of these is BMW, which recently announced it would be bringing its first hydrogen-powered vehicle into series production in 2028. Fortune caught up with BMW's group general project manager hydrogen technology and vehicle projects, Jürgen Guldner, at a recent summit proposing hydrogen-powered vehicles among other hydrogen evangelists. Toyota has been the leading seller of hydrogen-powered cars, with the Mirai launched in 2014, but it isn't the only player. Hyundai has been selling its Nexo since 2018, and Honda, after offering various cars under the Clarity name from 2008 to 2021, brought its CR-VE hydrogen-powered plug-in hydrogen car to market in 2024. BMW has been more cautious. The company has been trialing hydrogen-powered cars with a pilot run of vehicles based on X5 since 2023. The iX5 Hydrogen is already a credible vehicle, with smooth driving and a familiar X5 exterior. However, this won't necessarily be the vehicle that BMW will launch in 2028. The good news is, a hydrogen vehicle is an electric vehicle, says Guldner. It's just a different way of storing the energy versus a battery, which also means that we can reuse a lot of the components, like the electric motors in the cars from our BEVs. It also has a unique value proposition. It's the best of both worlds, with all the benefits of electric driving: acceleration, silent driving, zero emission. But you can refuel in 3 to 4 minutes, and you're 100% full and ready to go again. This has always seemed like a compelling argument for hydrogen on paper, but the reality has been that hydrogen refueling hasn't proliferated like battery-powered electric vehicle charging stations. In fact, it's gone backwards in many countries. In the UK, in 2019, there were as many as 15 hydrogen fuel stations, whereas today, in 2025, only 4 were listed, with 2 potentially not in service. By contrast, according to ZapMap, there were 39,733 public charging locations in the UK in May of 2025, with 80,998 devices and 115,241 connectors. Germany is better served for hydrogen refueling, but some European countries have no stations at all, such as Spain, Portugal, and Italy. Some hydrogen proponents argue that this is a strategic mistake if your goal is to decarbonize road transport. Hydrogen vehicles are complementary to battery electric vehicles and heading towards one common direction, said David Wong, head of technology and innovation at the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. If you invest in both charging infrastructure and the fuel cell hydrogen refueling infrastructure, the overall cost is lower. We've done modeling where they use Germany as an example. It shows that if we have a motor park penetration of 90% battery electrical vehicles and 10% hydrogen electrical vehicles, the overall cost of investing in infrastructure is $40 billion lower than the scenario where 100% of infrastructure is public charge points. There is also concern about resource usage when manufacturing battery electrical vehicles. Guldner points out batteries require a lot of raw materials, which could lead to scarcity. Having a second technology, not putting all eggs in one basket, provides resilience, he explains. BMW having 2 technologies is better than one. We got a lot of feedback from people saying battery electrical vehicles don't work for them. We're thinking about those people who can't or don't want to use battery electric cars, because maybe they don't have electrical charging at home or are on the road a lot and don't want to depend on charging stops, even if you can get them down to maybe 20 minutes. We have issues like towing in cold weather conditions. In the fuel cell, you can use excess heat, so you don't lose any range. This still leaves the problem with how you ramp up the infrastructure to support hydrogen. A commercial DC charger might be $50,000. A home charger can call $1,000. Or you can even use a very slow $200 mains plug cable. But the price for a hydrogen station is much greater, between $1.5 and $2 million, although some estimates are as much as $4 million. The solution, at least in the UK, is to target the long-haul commercial sector first and build out from that. HyHaul is a project aiming to achieve that. The biggest challenge with hydrogen is the fact that it works very well at large scale, but not so good at small scale, says Chris Jackson, CEO and founder of Protean Green Solutions, which co-founded HyHaul. One single hydrogen fueling station requires hundreds of passenger cars to make the economics work, but only a very small number of trucks. We're initially developing three major refueling stations, and all we need to get the project off the ground is 30 fuel cell trucks. The first stage will be along the M4 corridor. We'll be covering from Wales all the way into the M25 around London. Over time, we plan to extend across other networks, going up the M5 and the M6. For consumer adoption of hydrogen fuel vehicles, however, it would be necessary to cover the UK completely within half an hour driving distance, which would require about 1,300 stations. One of the reasons why Tesla was able to kick-start the electric car revolutions so effectively was its two-pronged approach of building the supportive charging infrastructure to go with the cars. Automakers developing hydrogen fuel cell cars have traditionally left this to third parties, leading to a chicken and egg situation, where car adoption awaits infrastructure and vice versa. This has meant that as BEVs have reached a tipping point in many markets, including the UK, EU, and China, while hydrogen vehicles wait in the wings. This hasn't prevented Toyota from persevering with hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Our role is to provide customers with choice, says John Hunt, Senior Manager, Hydrogen Transformation, Toyota GB. We can't have people dismissing technologies that are there to enable us all to learn and develop. Commercial vehicles could help hydrogen fuel cell vehicles reach that tipping point. In Paris, around 1,000 fuel cell taxis have been operated by Hype since 2015, the majority of which are Toyota Mirais. For this reason, Paris has 6 hydrogen fuel stops, with 3 more being built. This could lay the groundwork for consumers to adopt hydrogen fuel cell vehicles in the city. However, outside Paris, there is no supportive infrastructure yet, preventing long journeys beyond the urban limits. Hype also has recently said it is pivoting away from hydrogen fuel cell vehicles to battery electric vehicles. Even with full launch still 3 years away, BMW is placing a heavy bet on infrastructure having improved sufficiently for hydrogen to be a viable choice for consumers by 2028. Guldner notes that BMW hasn't yet decided which countries it will bring those vehicles to market, adding that it will depend upon the infrastructure. Right now, it's simply not here in the UK. But hopefully, in the next few years, development will pick up, he says. The exact model that will go into production in 2028 hasn't been announced. And while a price hasn't been unveiled either, BMW is hoping for parity with battery electric vehicles, Guldner says, pointing to previous dramatic cost reductions in other technologies, like batteries and solar cells. For these cost reductions to materialize, though, there has to be enough demand for fuel cell vehicles to deliver sufficient scale. I'm always surprised by surveys in newspapers where so many people say they would prefer a hydrogen vehicle over battery power, he says. There seems to be demand there. The question will be whether these survey responses translate into vehicle sales. In 2028, when BMW launches its production hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, we could find out. For those of you who follow the Federal Reserve, today is July 30th, and today is also the day in which the Fed meets and makes a decision about what to do with interest rates. Now, this show will not be broadcast until August 4th, the following Monday, so you probably already know. Nonetheless, here's what the Fed did today with regard to interest rates. This is from Fortune magazine. It's by Jeff Cox. Divided Fed holds key interest rates steady, defying Trump's demands for aggressive cuts. A divided Federal Reserve on Wednesday voted to keep its benchmark interest rates steady, despite a barrage of criticism from President Donald Trump and dissents from two top officials. The Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, the group that sets the overnight borrowing rate, voted 9-2 to stay on hold. The federal funds rate will continue to be set in a range between 4.25% to 4.5%. The level sets what banks charge each other for overnight lending, but influences a slew of other rates across the economy. However, the decision met opposition from Governors Michelle Bowman and Christopher Waller, both of whom advocated for the Fed to start easing in acknowledgement that inflation is under control and the labor market could start weakening soon. This was the first time since late 1993 that multiple governors cast no votes on a rate decision. The post-meeting statement offered only a couple of changes in how the committee views economic conditions. Although swings in net exports continues to affect the data, recent indicators suggest that growth of economic activity moderated in the first half of the year, the document stated. The unemployment rate remains low, and labor market conditions remain solid. Inflation remains somewhat elevated. At the June meeting, the committee had a more optimistic view, saying the economy continues to expand at a solid pace. The Wednesday statement said uncertainty about conditions remains elevated, also a less upbeat assessment from June, which noted that uncertainty had diminished but remains elevated. A slower economy would boost the argument for lower interest rates, though the committee stopped short of endorsing that view. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell will speak at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and could address whether the committee is tilting toward a rate cut at the next meeting in September. Markets had overwhelmingly expected no action on rates, but were watching the extent of disagreement on the committee, which normally has 12 voters, but without Governor Adriana Kugel at this meeting. Traders expect the Fed to cut in September, though that could change depending on the data flow. Fed officials in June narrowly indicated they see two cuts in total this year. The news follows a remarkable stretch for an entity with great sway over the economy, but one that has mostly avoided the political fray, at least overtly. Trump has called for Powell's resignation, and even toyed with the legally questionable idea of firing, though he's largely backed off the threat of sacking Powell. The president has kept up the criticism of a former appointee, whom he now regularly calls too late. The president has suggested the Fed lower its benchmark rate by 3 percentage points, which he said would lower borrowing costs on the surging national debt and help the moribund housing market. In addition to hectoring over rates, the Trump administration has ripped Powell and the central bank for cost overruns on a massive remodeling project at two of the Fed's buildings in Washington. Powell has insisted that the overruns are not the product of mismanagement, rather escalating costs since the project began. Wednesday brought more news that could influence the Fed's path, Trump's badgering notwithstanding. The Commerce Department reported that gross domestic product grew at a 3% annualized rate in the second quarter, considerably stronger than expected. Though much of the headline gain was propelled by reversion of massive import surge in the first quarter ahead of Trump's tariffs. The report nonetheless reinforced the notion of an economy still on solid ground. Moreover, the report showed inflation running at just a 2.1% rate for the period, according to the Fed's main forecasting tool. Core inflation was a bit higher at 2.5%, but both numbers plunged from their first quarter levels and neared the Fed's 2% bogey. We at the White House 100% respect their independence, but we also like to respect their analysis, National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett said Wednesday on CNBC. We expect that the Fed will catch up to the data soon. That's going to be a really big positive story. The Fed will next gather at its annual retreat in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in late August. The event historically has featured a major policy speech from the chair. Okay, so much for the Fed. Now here's the question for the day, and the answer to this question probably has nothing to do with any of us. This is by Eleanor Pringle. It is from Fortune Magazine, and it's dated July 29th. The title of the article is, Jeff Bezos' honeymoon plan seemed to involve a $5.7 billion Amazon share sell-off. Jeff Bezos' lavish wedding to Lauren Sanchez last month may have cost him a pretty penny, but even on the day of his nuptials, the Amazon founder was generating millions. On June 27th, the day Bezos and Sanchez said their vows, the billionaire sold millions of shares in online giant Amazon as a part of a wider plan to offload stock. An SEC filing seen by Fortune shows that on June 27th, Bezos sold more than 3.3 million Amazon shares at a price of between $2.21 and $2.23 a share. The resulting windfall for the transaction date of his wedding alone was $735 million, per Fortune calculations. And while other newlyweds might expect to see their wealth take a hit during their honeymoon, Bezos' wealth soared as he continued his sell-off with six further Form 4 filings made between late June and late July. Between July 3 and July 7th, Bezos offloaded a further 3 million shares at approximately $224 apiece. On July 8th and 9th, a further $500,000 shares were sold at a similar price, and between July 11th and July 14th, sold a further 6.7 million shares for between $224 and $226 a share. On July 15th, Bezos sold a further 733,000 shares for $227 each. And between July 21st and 22nd, offloaded a further 6.6 million shares at $227.50 to $229.50 each. The most recent transaction from July 23rd and July 24th also offloaded more than 4.1 million shares at between $228 to $233 apiece. The total sell-off, with Amazon stock up 5.5% over the past month alone, has netted Bezos some $5.7 billion in total, the Bloomberg Billionaires Index estimates. It's easy to assume that offloading millions of shares would reduce Bezos' stake significantly in the company, with a market cap of nearly $2.5 trillion. Not so, as the SEC filings reveal Bezos still owns approximately 884 million Amazon shares. This puts him roughly on a par with some of Amazon's largest institutional shareholdings. Yahoo Finance, for example, reports Vanguard as the top institutional shareholder with 832 million shares. With Amazon stock up 26% over the past year and up roughly 46% over the past half decade, Bezos now sits on a net worth of $252 billion, making him the third richest person on the planet. Of course, Bezos himself isn't orchestrating the sales of millions of shares on a weekly basis. The SEC filings show the stock sales are occurring according to an SEC Rule 10b5-1 trading plan established in early May. The rule creates a standard practice for an officer of a publicly traded company to sell shares in a pre-planned way without accusations of insider trading. The 10b5-1 plan has a number of stipulations, chief among them that a formula, not a person, determines the number, price, and date of the trades. A third party who cannot be influenced by the client must also be employed to conduct the sales. Similar action has been taken by Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai in recent weeks, who used 10b5-1 filings to offload shares while achieving a billionaire wealth status. But Bezos' SEC history also reveals the billionaire is offloading sales not only for wealth, but also for philanthropy. On June 27th, the same day Bezos' sell-off began, Morgan Stanley filed a note on behalf of Bezos in a Form 144 filing. The filing reads, on May 13th, May 14th, and June 15th, 2025, the reporting person contributed 633,812 shares to nonprofit organizations, which may have sold such shares during the 3 months preceding the date of this Form 144. The form does not reveal which organizations received the shares. While Bezos has not signed the giving pledge, a commitment from the world's wealthiest to donate the majority of their fortunes to philanthropy, he has publicly stated that he intends to donate the majority of his wealth during his lifetime to philanthropic causes, telling CNN in 2022 he was building the capacity to be able to give away this money. For those of you who were fans of crypto, this next article might interest you. It's from Fortune magazine by Ben Weiss, dated July 28th. PayPal to let U.S. businesses accept payment in more than 100 cryptocurrencies. Fintech giant PayPal launched a new payment option on Monday that will let smaller U.S. merchants accept more than 100 cryptocurrencies, including mainstays like Bitcoin and Ethereum, but also zanier options like Trump's meme coin and even the novelty token Fartcoin. Any U.S. business using PayPal's online payments processing platform can opt in, said a spokesperson. PayPal will charge merchants a promotional fee of 99/100% on transactions for the first year, and then up the charge to 1.5%. Frank Keller, an executive vice president, told Fortune, "Those fees are less than the 1.5% average rate that U.S. businesses paid to credit card companies in 2024, according to the Nilson report. There's a worldview where you can imagine that the world is moving on-chain," said Keller, referring to putting data on blockchains. Is this happening overnight? No. Some people say long time periods. Other people say in very short time periods. I think we'll see movement. To settle the transactions, PayPal will let users connect existing crypto wallets they own to a checkout page. Depending on a buyer's crypto wallet, PayPal will sell the cryptocurrency on a centralized exchange like Coinbase, or a decentralized exchange like Uniswap. The proceeds of that sale will be converted into PayPal's own stablecoin, which will then be converted into U.S. dollars sent back to the merchant. Imagine a shopper in Guatemala buying a special gift from a merchant in Oklahoma City, Alex Chris, president and CEO of PayPal, said in a statement. Using PayPal's open platform, the business can accept crypto for payments. The move to let customers pay businesses with crypto is PayPal's latest push into digital assets. Among the Fortune 500, the fintech giant has been an early adopter of crypto. In 2020, PayPal said that U.S. users would be able to buy, sell, and hold a select group of cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin and Ethereum. It then expanded that capacity to Venmo. But during the so-called crypto winter of 2022, PayPal ratcheted down its public rhetoric on crypto. Now, as crypto markets are soaring and President Donald Trump's administration casts a favorable light on digital assets, it's charging ahead. In September, it let businesses buy, hold, and sell crypto from their merchant accounts. And its stablecoin, PYUSD, which the company launched in 2023, has increased its market capitalization about 70% since the beginning of the year to about $850 million, according to CoinGecko. PayPal plans to expand the ability for merchants to accept crypto to larger enterprise customers in the U.S. and globally, but a spokesperson declined to provide the timeline. Our final two short articles are from Forbes Daily. They're dated July 25th. It continues to be a rough year for the airline industry as two major carriers slashed their 2025 forecasts Thursday. Southwest Airlines cut its outlook for full-year earnings by more than half, while American Airlines adjusted its 2025 earnings per share estimates significantly downward, leading shares to tank 11.2% and 9.6% respectively. The travel industry is still struggling to recover from President Donald Trump's sweeping tariff announcement in April, which considerably slowed bookings. Airline executives say the demand is stabilizing, though it remains to be seen how the tariff slated to go into effect August 1st will impact consumers, who tend to pull back on discretionary expenses like travel when inflation is elevated. The Federal Communications Commission approved the $8 billion merger between Paramount and Skydance Media on Thursday, after Skydance said it would end diversity, equity, and inclusion considerations in hiring, promotions, development, and compensation. In her dissent, Biden FCC appointee Ana Gomez called it only the beginning of the Trump administration's assault on the First Amendment in the wake of Paramount's agreement to settle a 60 Minutes lawsuit brought by President Donald Trump for $16 million. Please excuse the political overtones of that last article, and that is all we have time for today. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, the program of Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11 a.m.